There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
We have merch. Check out the AmericanGlutton.net shop. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and more. A number of people have come up to me wearing American Glutton merch, and nothing fills my heart with more pride than seeing somebody in one of these t-shirts. And I've been stopped on the street and asked where to get it when somebody sees me in an American Glutton hoodie. Well, you can get it all at the shop on AmericanGlutton.net. And my favorite t-shirt, Yesterday It Was Tomorrow, Right Now, is up now. Get it while supplies last.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment. Food as sport. Food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from. My guest today is Rod Blackhurst. He is a writer and director. Him and I did a movie together called Blood for Dust. You can see it starting April 19th. And you can find him on Instagram at Rod Blackhurst. Rod Blackhurst, welcome to the American Glutton Podcast.
Oh, man, thanks for having me.
I'm so
I don't even know. How do you begin a podcast? I don't even know.
Well,
what am I supposed to say? Thank you.
No, yeah. Let's say, first and foremost, mostly on this podcast, we're talking about health and fitness and stuff like that. But I'm also an actor, and so today we're talking about movies. This is going to be exciting.
Well, we can talk about fitness and healthy choices and decisions and process addiction and all those things too. Like, we can. I want to talk about it all. Like, I'm very stoked to be here.
Yeah, we can talk about a little bit about my anxiety going away to work and how, like, the most important things that I tell my lawyer nowadays are I have to have a kitchen. And my lawyer's like, your team wants more money. And I'm like, I don't care about that. Just get me a kitchen, you know?
Yeah, you told me that when you were going to come to Montana. It was a gym, kitchen, and access to, like, a good grocery store, right?
That was
I think, like, vegetables and meat.
Those have become my primary concerns, you know, because, like, you go to a place that you're not familiar with, and it's like, what's easy? Easy is fast food. And then, you know, and eating on set, it's like, I have no control over what's on set. I did a movie in Mexico, Rod, where, like, I got so specific with everything down to the gram of protein. Like, it was like, you have to give me, like, in my contract, legal. You have to give me 250 grams of chicken breast four times a day. You know, a cup of white rice. This is just one of those stupid things that like you can do, I guess. And my lawyer was like, okay, let's get specific. And even still, it was like, you know, I'd get fried chicken and I'd be like, this is not, you guys, I don't want to make a fuss, but this, like, we went over this very specifically. That was a situation where we moved a lot and there was no, it wasn't like you can have a kitchen and you can have access to a grocery store. In Mexico City, I did. And then we started traveling around Mexico and it was like, no, you're 4 hours from a grocery store. So you can have a kitchen, but that's not going to do anything for you.
In Montana, it was so cold. Like, I never like had the time to pay attention to what people were eating or not eating, but like we were fueling up all the time because we had to stay warm and like calories were the way to like generate energy. Did you, sure. were you eating the crafty there, the catering there? Do you remember anything about that? Like, I have no idea what you did.
I don't even look at crafty. I will look at catering. I will say, catering was good. And I can't remember the guy's name, but he was almost like a cowboy.
Bit. His name Bit. Was Bit. Yeah, he was Bit. A cowboy. Yeah, I think his name was Bit. Yeah.
He was awesome. And he would always come up to me every single day and go, I'm making you salmon. And I'd go, Bit, thank you so much, but I've brought my own food every day. Every single day. I've got salmon for you. And I'd say, Bit, thank you. I appreciate that, but I've brought my own. Because you don't know, and because I don't know, and because I have no control over it, I really do try to just bring my own food, which is not always possible. It's just not, you know, in Montana, my work schedule and my workload was enough that it afforded me like plenty of time at night to meal prep for the next day. Or if I had two big days back to back, I could, you know, prep ahead of time and just grab shit out of the fridge and microwave it at work.
Yeah, I love that. I do something similar. Like, a couple years ago, like I went through like a health situation and I changed my diet and my approach to food, but I travel with my own stash of gluten-free nut bars and peanut butter bars and dried fruits and almonds and things like this. I have them in my backpack all the time. Just yesterday, I had to eat like two bars. It was all I could find, right? But it was like sort of the way to ensure that I always had the thing that I needed that was the healthiest, and no matter where I was. So whether I'm in rural India on a commercial or in the middle of like Montana, sometimes we'd be location scouting and be like, hey, you can have this brown food. And I'd be like, I can't do that. That's going to destroy me. It's going to mess up the rest of my day. So I respect traveling with your own salmon. Like, that's also a unique thing to be traveling with of all the meats, or I guess all the proteins, you know. But yeah. I do love that.
I was in, this was the oddest. I was recently in Vancouver, and these, think I'm blanking on what they're called here in America. They're natives in Canada. I think they're indigenous peoples. And I met these folks and the guy was like, I wanted to bring you smoked salmon. I make smoked salmon, but I didn't think you'd want to take it from me. And I was like, dude, I'll try your smoked salmon. And he came back, like left, and came and found me and just had a Ziploc bag of this smoked salmon. And it's not like smoked salmon how I think of it, as like the Jewish deli makes smoked salmon. This was where they took like big, thick, almost fillets that you'd cut lengthwise. So like, you know, 2 inches by 2 inches, and then like 6 or 8 inch long strips of salmon that he smoked and put flavoring on. And dude, it was fucking incredible. And man, I walked around for like a week with a bag of this smoked salmon, just reeking of salmon and loving it. Traveled back into America, probably broke 12 federal laws bringing it into America.
Perfect.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Perfect. As you should. The salmon's not going to really cause any of our collapse. That
right.
Probably coming.
Yeah. I didn't destroy some ecosystem with my salmon, which I very quickly ate once I was here. I've so many times sat down on a plane next to my wife and opened a Tupperware and just had her turn white with like embarrassment and nausea and gone like, you're not allowed to create that smell on an airplane. And I'm like, it does. It just smells like food. And she's like, no, you have no idea what salmon and cabbage that has been sitting in Tupperware for 2 hours smells like. And I'm like, well, it smells good to me and I'm going to eat it.
Oh man. Hearing you talk about that salmon right now, I want that salmon. It makes me like immediately recall this experience I had a couple of years ago. In the pandemic, in the fall of the pandemic, I went to Alaska to work on this National Geographic show that Will Smith hosts. Can't remember the name of it right now, but we were in Haines, Alaska. We had like, you know, spent all this time quarantining to get there. And then we were really in this bubble because that was just whatever the year it was. And, but the locals, even in, I guess this was August, they, every day, I believe they were afforded a certain number of salmon they could take that, like, just as a native Alaskan, if I'm remembering correctly. Anyway, there were several of the local crew who showed up with bags of smoked salmon that they had smoked very recently, like maybe the day before. But also, like, every gas station was selling a local's version of pickled, or like salmon in oil, I guess, or what it was. And it just looked like my mom had jarred up some stuff and there was no label on it. And it was so good. And I carried it around as well, because it was like, you would just take this tranche of salmon out of whatever, I guess it was probably oil, right? Like, and it was just dripping and it was so good. And I could just like guzzle them down. And actually right now, hearing you talk about that salmon in Vancouver, I want that salmon that I had in Alaska. I could eat, I could stink up this whole house and be stoked about it.
My mouth is watering right now thinking of the jarred salmon. It's crazy. But
it's so crazy. Yeah.
You know, to your point about carrying around brown stuff, like I think I certainly for a long time in my life got totally like comfortable maybe knowing that there was always food available to me. And then one of the big fears I had when I like tried to switch over, and I switched number of times before I found like a route and a path that really worked well for me, which mostly excludes all the food you can buy in an airport or at a gas station. But there was like this fear of like, I'm going to be miserable all the time. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to have a bite of food that brings me joy. And like now, when I think of something, like if you held up that jarred salmon versus anything that's available at a gas station, I'm choosing the salmon. Like that is going to actually spark more joy in me than Nutter Butters or a cheap salami stick, or you know, I remember I used to get these cheeseburgers at AMPM. I don't even know if AMPM exists anymore, but it was like a version of 7-Eleven, and they'd have cheeseburgers wrapped in foil that sat under a heat lamp for hours and hours and hours until I went in and got them. And I remember like loving these cheeseburgers, and you'd open it up and it was like beige. It didn't resemble meat at all, but it probably had a lot of bread in it in the patty.
Oh yeah.
And I just loved them.
Slimy and silvery?
Totally. It was disgusting. Like I wouldn't eat it today, but I remember really loving these things. And I remember there was a long period where I was like, I'm going to miss, what does my life mean without that other shit? And you find joy in these things. You find joy. And I'm sure there's something you found that you keep in your backpack. Like I've got fucking snacks that are always in my backpack, so much so that I often have to go like, oh, I need to eat this now so I can replace it so that it's not like goes too long without being touched, that I like. I actually like them.
I love it too. I mean, so I cut out gluten in 2020 as a response to a thyroid issue that I was having. And I started taking some pills, and the pills didn't feel like they were working. But my general practitioner at the time was like, hey, this is something that you could do, right, to cut down on inflammation. And that was causing the hypothyroidism. And now I crave the things that the new habits that I've discovered, right? Like you're talking about with the foods you would choose to have out of a gas station. And so it's funny because like I too look to those things and want them and desire them. But I think about that just as it relates to sort of the general holistic life way of like the way water cuts through stone, and you become ingrained in your habits and in your behavior. And if you can reroute it, or if you can work to reroute the water, like, you know, you will become ingrained in new habits and in new routines. And I too crave those foods. And people ask me sometimes, well, man, do you miss gluten? And I immediately talk about the things that I've learned relative to like my health situation and what it afforded me health-wise. And I don't miss it. And frankly, I crave the gluten-free versions of those things that I now eat daily or have in my bag, like, you know, these peanut butter pro bars or these pumpkin, these raw pumpkin seed bars that have just like pumpkins and dates and chia seed. There's maybe like five ingredients. I legit want to eat them just so I can have more of them with me, like you're talking about.
Dude.
Anyway, it's relatable.
I'm not absolutely gluten-free. I just happen to not eat a lot of food with gluten in it. Like I try more than anything to like be aware of the amount of fat that I consume. And so when I reintroduced gluten and bread and stuff like that back into my diet, I found very quickly that without fat, it's fucking boring. Like a piece of bread on its own does not, unless my daughter and I bake a loaf of sourdough, but even then I want butter on it. You know what I mean? Like it by itself is not doing it for me. Pasta with no sauce, because even the tomato sauce is loaded with oil. I can't mess with that. But the point of all of this was at one point there was like, and this I discovered many years ago, like I'm going to eat pizza and I wanted to eat gluten-free pizza and then it sucked. And I was like, this is a waste of time. I'm not going to eat this. And then this place popped up in Los Angeles called Lucifer's Pizza. And I had a piece of their gluten-free. And honestly, I crave that more than almost any other pizza. Like my favorite pizza was always Joe's in New York. And I'd rather have Lucifer's gluten-free than
like a classic $1.25 slice, like, you know, like a greasy slice where you can drip it and like, you can't get it out of your clothing ever.
Yeah. Right. Which I mean, my kids are always patting dry. And I'm like, you're getting rid of the best part.
Yeah. The best part. You're supposed to drink that. Like, don't you know? Like,
make a shot out of it.
This is like, man, gluten-free pizza for the most part is terrible. Right. Like, and there's a pizza. Well, they actually have several locations now here in Nashville, but started in Brooklyn. And we found it when we lived in Brooklyn called Emmy's. And I think here they're called Emmy Squared. But whatever flour they're using for their gluten-free version is like, I crave it. And I share it with everybody who's like, oh, I'm going to know the difference and I'm going to not like this. And I go, how about you just like, what do you think about that? And they're like, oh man, that pizza is some of the best pizza I've ever had. And I'm like, well, there you go. Like, don't yuck someone's yum, you know, like just because you don't know what it is. So anyway, I think about all this stuff all the time. I mean, it's sitting here, like this is way off topic, but way off topic. Well, I'm talking more and more about food, but like, I think about like gluten in France, and I'm not celiac, but this was like a response to this thyroid issue that I was going through. But gluten in Europe and just the food processing generally, from literally soil to table, is I can eat all of the bread there, all the croissant, all the baguettes, like all the pastries, and in most of Europe, even in England, and the food is just generally cleaner. And I've thought about that endlessly. And granted, I'm not celiac, so I have a gluten intolerance, I guess you could say it, And anyway, it's remarkable to me that like I can eat all of the food in Europe and I can't eat any of that stuff here in the States. And I've done a little research. Certainly, I know nothing compared to you and what you know about, like, your knowledge is far more vast, I at least based on what I know from having listened to your podcast and having knowing you a little bit. It boggles my mind the differences in our food qualities and processes, you know, from Europe to the States. And that to me was like a insane sign.
I wanted to, there was a point in my life where I wanted to really rally against that sentiment and like tell my wife, no, that's bullshit. There's no scientific evidence to back that up. But then anecdotally, I've had the same experience where I go to Europe, I eat, nothing is off limits. I don't put one restriction or one limitation on myself at all. And then I come home and I've had no weight gain, where if there have been periods, like, let's say I go, like, I'm not just going to have Christmas Day. I'm going to have Christmas week to New Year's and then a New Year's blowout. And I'm not going to be dieting, you know, for my kids' sanity sake, where they're like, let's order, you know, the beef dip sandwiches from Chicago and have them flown in on dry ice and eat that and have fucking, let's go nuts. Right. And I'm like, okay, great. We're doing it. We're really doing it. We're Americans this year. And I'll gain 15 pounds. That does not happen to me in Europe when I take the guide rails away. So, you know, I don't know if it's that we walk more or what, or it's their food or what it is, but I have had that same experience. Yeah. So I'm like tired of trying to argue my wife out of it where she's like, just eat this here. And I'm like, yes, I will, because I know it's not going to harm me somehow. Yeah.
I don't know too much more than like, a, you know, than this, than what I'm talking about. I just know that my experience, right? Like I can speak to it and I go, it boggles my mind. Like there's something going on. I don't know what the research is, but we asked somebody the last time we were in Europe, this actually, which was this September, for our movie played at a film festival in France. And I, like my wife noted very quickly, she's like, how many pastries and all these things are you going to eat? And I was like, I'm going to eat every single one. Like I'm going to find a reason to go eat them because I can, and it's not going to mess me up. And so it's like the, you know, the positive benefit of like having a movie screened at a film festival in France is I got to eat all the bread.
Yeah. Like, which is so great. You know, when you take that, it's fun to take that restriction away. And then you come back home and you're like, but the bread here is less appealing, man. There's no TLC put into a loaf of bread you buy at the grocery store. Maybe Dave's Hardcore Bread, you can get a sense that there's a guy who at one point felt passionate about this bread. But once it hits Ralph's or John's or Publix or Safeway or some grocery store chain, it's like, no, there's no care. You're hard pressed to find some food in Europe that didn't begin at least with somebody who really was passionate about that food.
Well, there's the other thing that like we realized again, and maybe this came from somebody telling us this, is that like, think about the number of bread products in the United States that have shelf life, right? So bread that comes in a bag is squishy, and you know, sliced bread, pre-sliced bread, or even crackers and cookies and all these things, if they stay sealed on a shelf in a relatively moisture-free environment, they will stay fresh for a long time. And the reason they're staying fresh is added gluten that's in addition to the natural gluten that's already present in wheat or in wheat natural wheat. In Europe, things go bad by the end of the day, right? If you buy a baguette at the store or a croissant and you leave it on your counter, or you, even if you wrap it up in the bag it comes in, or the, you know, the paper bag or whatever it might be, it's going to be rock hard, especially 24 hours later.
Yeah, and it's only good for soup that, the next day. You can only put it in soup.
Oh, man, and I want that now. Right. You talk about that. So, I don't know, man, I'm way off topic. Gosh, I don't know how, like, I just... You started talking about salmon and I started thinking about like foods I was craving, and here we are. And like, we're not talking about movies. I guess we're talking about, I mean, I know your podcast is about these things.
No, but it can be about, it's like, about anything. It's also just about our experiences. I want to know, like you started talking about a film festival in France. That was Deauville.
Yeah, it was the Deauville, I think it's the Deauville American Film Festival. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it's an incredible film festival.
Just as a comparison, you know, look, I'm very happy in America. I think America is a great country. Like, and of course, I can find ways to be critical of anything, right? I could be critical of the French bread and I could be critical of America, but I've been to that film festival and it's just so lovely. And there's something for me about the European celebration of cinema that is done almost in a more reverent way than we do it here. Do you agree with that? Was that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love America too, and I love all of the things we have, and you know, not going to put the French Film Festival more on a pedestal than any of my film festival experiences here in North America. There was a reverence to it. And so, and I think about it, the only way I could think about it is this, that like the arts and creative works are primary experiences and things that are valued in a very primary, important way in people's lives and in culture's life and in community and just the way the society works there. And I feel like here, everything is like, is not a primary experience. It's like people are listening to a podcast while watching a movie, or they're tweeting while, you know, they're doing all these things concurrently. And I really feel like in Europe, people engage with things directly. It's like museum culture. I'm not a museum guy. In fact, like I don't really ever want to go to a museum, if I'm being honest, and I'm going to admit that right now. I don't want to go sit in a museum and look at something. My relationship to creative works is very different. But like in Europe, people go to a museum and they want to just sit there and look at things and experience it and read about it. They do the same thing with cinema, and they value it and they care about it, and they want to talk about all aspects of it. And that reverence and that respect, like, was very emotional for me. You know, our film Blood for Dust that we made, I think it screened for like 1200 people in this non-cinema, like, meaning it screened in a space in Deauville. I believe you've been to the same space. Yeah. It's not a traditional cinema. It's, I think, a performing arts center, but yeah, it's remarkable seating, remarkable screen, remarkable projection, remarkable sound. And everybody was there for every single minute of it. And they were there for every single minute of the Q&A. People that didn't even have a connection to film, right? There were people going to those film festivals that were not in the industry, that were just cinephiles or people that lived in town. And for them, it was a cultural experience. Every year they would go because they could get, they could have access to some creative work and author, or, you know, or filmmaker, or an author, I mean, author in the, like, the authorship version of that, like, and they could, it would add something to their life. And it made me want to be a better, you know, shepherd and steward of my work and of film generally, because they cared, and I wanted them to know that I cared about them and why they were there and what they were affording me. It was really remarkable. It really was, unlike anything I've ever had. What film did you have at Deauville, by the way? I don't think we talked about that.
I didn't. I went with a buddy. A buddy of mine. I'm trying to remember what movie it was. I had a friend, I think it was maybe the Cider House Rules, and we went to Deauville and Venice, and we went all, and possibly one in Berlin, but it was a very long time ago. But I there was a time from the mid 90s to the early 2000s for like 10 years straight that I went to the Sundance Film Festival. And I think in like 96, my first experience with Sundance was, I'm going to every movie. And I had blocked out times and struggled and calling agents to get tickets to different things. And that's all I did. I went to movies. And then the next year I had a movie there, and my experience was different, but I had a movie. So I had to do press and I had to participate more. And then I had a fucking movie at Sundance for like 7 years in a row. And I noticed
that's an insane run.
It was crazy. And movies, from movies in competition to movies just premiering there to all of everything in between. And you know, I liked the experience I had the first time going, where I was just watching movies, because I am a cinephile. I love movies. Movies for me, you know, I have been my entire life so uncomfortable with reality that I like to use for a long time food and then drugs to escape. And movies have been the cleanest escape for me. You know what I mean? It's just a break. It's not an actual escape, but like I go and I get this other universe, this other experience, and I get to exist in that. And it relaxes me and it makes me feel like I'm a part of something else. And they posit new realities, or they present different viewpoints than I have. And I just find that experience to be wonderful. And then I come back into reality as reality is. And, you know, for a long time, my work has been trying to just experience reality and not try to escape it. And the only escape I really have today that's clean and natural and healthy is movies. So I've loved movies since I was a little kid. Going to a film festival and spending, you know, 8 hours a day running from one theater to the next to catch every possible movie that I could was an amazing experience. By the end of Sundance, I was like, I never want to go back here. This is awful. It's parties and it's people trying to get you to a place so they can give you garbage that you wind up just throwing away, and they take a picture of you with it, and it's fantastical nightclubs, and like that to me just stresses me out about reality. It's not the joyous escape that I want. So it became about drugs and dinners and utilizing food to escape, and like all, it just got gross. But what I noticed about Europe is that was not a part of it. Now, certainly I've also been to Cannes a number of times, and they're celebrating there's almost two separate experiences in Cannes. There is the let's go to an insane nightclub, but everybody's in a tuxedo because they just came from basically worshiping movies. Like the cinema love that you see those Europeans where it's like, no, you have to wear a fucking tuxedo to come see this movie because this is like
reverence.
It's reverence. And so like Cannes, I like less than Deauville simply because it had that element which I've been working to stay away from. But like right. You just stick to the part that you're supposed to, I felt like Sundance for me lost that a little bit because there wasn't a reverence. It was very much more about commerce, I felt.
I've never been to Sundance, but it does seem to be about the scene and those things that are tertiary, right? That are not about that primary experience. And hearing you talk about Cannes as well, like, right, there is a bit of like show to it, right? Or like there's expectations that are very different from Deauville, right? And Deauville, I mean, most people here in the States, unless you're a cinephile or a filmmaker, you might not know about Deauville. But what I found interesting in France is that like the common people knew about the film festival in Deauville in that region. And even people I knew around France had heard of it, right? And that to me was remarkable. It's at least on their radar, right? And I wonder sometimes how many people in the States know about Sundance at all that aren't a part of the film industry in some way, or like deep cinephiles too. Man, you're saying so many things that are making me want to ask so many questions, but I have two questions for you that I'm dying to know the answers to here in a second. But I do want to say that like my lifelong dream has been to go to Cannes with a movie. And that comes from the fact that like my godparents are de facto grandparents were from the south of France. And so I grew up going to spend summers there as a kid, and I grew up speaking French, and my mother was a public school French teacher. And I want nothing more than to dress up like a goober in a nice tuxedo.
Yes.
And go return the reverence though to the culture, right? So to go speak French and to go talk to people about my movie and French, and to show them that like I care about you as a culture and as people who care about culture in return. And that it's sort of just this personal thing, but it's to me it's like it's the place I want to get to so badly. And I think about it far too often. I mean, again, I've never been to Sundance, I've never been to Cannes, but I would like to go to Cannes real bad.
I'm just gonna keep rambling about this. I think your experience, I'm sure you'll go to both, and I believe your experience will be better at Cannes simply because, I mean, fuck, your origin story already is the pathway to having like a monumental life experience at Cannes. So that's a given. But I think if you took away all of that, the two things are, you don't have to go to the nightclubs at Cannes. That's not a fucking requisite part of attending the film festival. And it in fact has nothing to do with the film festival. I think more people, and look, even if I'm being completely honest, I think a lot of people show up in Cannes and Saint-Tropez and all the, and Antibes and all these areas during that film festival for the ancillary things that are occurring there because of the film festival, and because you got a bunch of actors in town and rich people and rock stars and, you know, fancy people show up, and it's like, well, who's got the best nightclub tonight on that coast? But I think there's less commodification of that in France. You go to Sundance And again, I haven't been in a while because I was so turned off the last time I went. And it is just like business. It's and a shitload of people show up to go skiing and to go to the nightclubs and go to the parties. But like, there's so much more emphasis on, and look, I'm a capitalist. Like, I believe that like you make a product, you should have, it should enter into the market. But when I think with art, it gets tricky because if you're making something for the market, and it's very tricky because movies cost money more than a painting, right? And if, you know, like if we just listen to, Rick Rubin about this kind of thing. And if you make it for the audience, you're fucking up already. And I think there's more emphasis put on in Cannes. If they watch a movie that the audience doesn't respond to, but they can feel that the director got his vision across perfectly, they're going to acknowledge that. And they're going to say, you did a fantastic job. Where at Sundance, it's more just like, how can we sell this?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I mean, I think that speaks to, like, again, they see art for the value of the work itself, right? It's, I mean, I too am a capitalist, like an entrepreneur, all these things. Like, and I want to be the steward and the shepherd of my work and these ideas. But I do think, right, that there is value and at times it feels like there is value in the United States for things that like don't reach a large audience, but they can singularly be appreciated and known for their contributions. Again, you were talking about this, like the different viewpoints they posit or the experiences they speak to or the realities they address, and like and they don't have to reach a large audience, but to have that value be seen. But it does seem rare. And there it is, like, right. Even in Deauville, I would have people come up to me on the street and ask me questions. They'd say, hey, we were at the screening. We heard you talk, or we heard you talking, having a conversation in the hallway. I'd like to ask you a question about this thing. And I was like, who are you? What are you? And they're like, oh, you know, like I work in the market downtown. And I'm like, you're here like wanting to ask me about this American crime thriller movie set in Montana. Like I don't know. There was something so magical and special about it. So I want to get back to France. I want to get back to, you know, I want to go to Cannes, but I have to ask you about this question before I forget about it. You were talking about, like, I too love movies and not that I want to escape from my reality, because I very much, like being present. And specifically, like, I used to smoke a lot of weed, right? Or not a lot of weed, but enough weed that, like, one of the things I didn't like about it was that, or I thought I liked about it was the way it gave me the chance to to detach a little bit or drift away. And I've really found that what I do like is being able to be very present and engaged with things and feel very aware of it. I oftentimes say I go to movies to escape for a minute, right? To get to experience something else, to get to, I don't know, feel magical, feel alive, get invigorated. I saw Dune 2 last night. The last night it was in cinemas. I went and saw it in IMAX and I walked out at the shopping mall. It was like 10:30 at night. No one was around. I found myself like jumping in the parking lot and like kind of fist punching the air. And I was just, dude, I was like, man, why am I
feeling
so
fucking good? It's so fucking good. I watched it in Florida and then I made a trip to New York to take my kids to see it in IMAX. I was like, you guys aren't going to see this without me. I'm coming to New York to take you to see this. And we're going to have an experience together. It's so fucking good.
Yeah, it fired me up, right? And I like, and that to me is like a drug in some ways. Like I love that. Maybe it's not a drug. Wouldn't mean it would be a negative thing. I would only be doing that instead of like taking care of my kids or my dog. But like, I don't know. Like I love movies for the same reasons you're talking about, and have always loved them. I grew up without a TV, but this begs my question: like, how the hell did you end up in your first movie? How did you like? Your first movie was Mallrats, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very first movie.
How
did you come to be in Mallrats? You had loved movies. Like, was there did you have a reverence and I have no idea how movies happen, how they get made. Like, and then was there a moment where the reality of that, like, or what you learned and experienced, you like changed your relationship to movies and your viewership and the way you engage with them? Like, I have to know. Like maybe you've talked about it before, but I need to know.
No, I don't think I've talked. I mean, I've talked about it a little bit on here. It's a very interesting story. My experience with movies started when I was very young, and there was a video store, you know, right next to a place that my mom liked to stop on. Like, she'd pick us up from school and we'd be driving home, and there was like a little strip mall that had this, like, it was called Tosa Express. It was this little Asian restaurant, which had, you know, at the time was like, not vegan. It was organic, which in the 80s was not super common, but it existed. It was like a healthy Asian restaurant that was fast also. So we would stop there, and in that strip mall was a little video, like a mom and pop video store. And I would go in and I just went through the Humphrey Bogart section, the James Cagney section, the Hitchcock section.
Okay, you had the good shit. You had the real stuff.
The Truffaut section. Like, it was amazing. And then, you know, later in life that closed down and I had to go all the way to Santa Monica to a place called Vidiot's, which was a video rental store that had
legendary,
incredible stuff. To go further with the stuff I was watching. That was me at like 8, 9, 10 years old. Then I had a troubled youth. I just stopped going. I started refusing to go to school at like 14, got arrested, had some patchy trouble. At 16, my mom was like, look, you have to do something. You can't, like, what are you going to be, a bum? You won't go to school. We don't want you to go to jail. You've already had run-ins with the law. What are you going to do? So I was like, well, I really like doing this show in a kind of a lot went into it. Like I was in a school that had actors, and I observed that people didn't see them as who they were, but saw them as the characters they played on TV, like Punky Brewster. I went to school with her, and Soleil Moon Frye, wonderful girl who I've known since I was like 11 years old. Nobody at school really saw Soleil Moon Frye. They saw Punky Brewster. And this to me was really intriguing because I hated being seen. I hated being viewed.
Oh, so you could be someone else. I could
disguise myself if I was an actor. That there was a flip side too. When acting, my body was correct. It did not matter that I was fat. It did not matter that I wasn't good at sports. Whatever character I was playing, my body was correct as that character. And the feeling of relief that I would get when acting in those moments. It would disappear the minute I was off the stage. It would disappear the minute it would be overwhelming prior to starting a scene. Like, people are going to laugh at me, this, that, the other thing, I'm embarrassed, all these feelings. The minute I started actually doing it, playing the character. And so I wasn't ashamed of myself, because I was exactly who I was supposed to be to play that character. It didn't matter what the character was. I was correct. And it was the only time I felt the self-loathing that I experienced kind of all the time evaporate. And so it felt like triumphant to play any character. And then when so 16, I started going to acting school. I didn't have a great time at acting school, acting class. I was the youngest person there. Everybody else was like mid-20s, out of college. I was 16 years old. I didn't fit in very well. And I had like a bit of a tumultuous relationship with my acting coach. And finally, I was like, fuck this. I'm not doing acting school anymore. I'm just going to go out and try to learn to act while acting. I had headshots made. There was a newspaper called Backstage. So you get this newspaper, and in the classifieds, it say like agent seeking talent. I sent out all these pictures and resumes to people. One guy wrote back and he was like, I'm going to try you out. Let's see how you do. The first day of auditions, I had an audition for Melrose Place at like, I had an audition for Boy Meets World at, this was like 1993 or 94, an audition for Boy Meets World in the morning. And then I had to go all the way to Santa Monica for an audition for Melrose Place. I go to Boy Meets World, get in my car, drive all the way to Melrose Place, do that audition, come out. As I come out, I get a call. They're going to offer you the role for Melrose Place. You got a job. First day of auditioning. I'm like, fuck yeah. And then like 5 minutes later, he calls me back and he goes, they didn't realize you weren't in the union. They're not going to hire you, but you have a callback for Boy Meets World. Go back to Disney in Burbank, because the producers want to see you. So I'm fucking sad. I go back to Disney, go in, read for the producers, walk out. And 5 minutes later, he calls me and he says, you got that job, and they don't care that they're going to Taft Hartley you. That's, I don't even know how it works anymore, but that's like, we're going to buy your way into the union. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody can get Taft Hartley.
Yeah. And so my first job was Boy Meets World. And it was fucking awesome. And then I wound up doing like 25 episodes of Boy Meets World. And Mallrats came like a year later. It was the first.
Was it Boy Meets World? Was the visibility from Boy Meets World that got you you into Mallrats?
Nobody had seen I mean, Boy Meets World was really a kid's show when it was on. Yeah. So nobody who was involved with Mallrats had seen Boy Meets World. I did do a commercial somewhere between Boy Meets World and Mallrats, which I think that Kevin Smith had seen the commercial. It was a crazy commercial for Sega, where I'm sitting in a park playing a Nintendo Game Boy, and it's all monochromatic, and I'm like bored, and I look down and there's a dead squirrel, and I pick the dead squirrel up and I hit myself in the head with the dead squirrel, and suddenly I'm seeing colors, and I'm like happy that I now see colors. And then it cuts to Sega Game Gear has color, and it's like all fucking crazy, right? And so that
commercial, I can't wait to fucking find this commercial.
People love that commercial. That commercial played so much. It was a very big popular commercial. And Kevin Smith had seen that.
They don't make commercials like they used to.
No,
that's for sure.
Like, no. Today, that would be a Super Bowl commercial. That was that good. And that was just a run-of-a-mill commercial back then. The Mallrats audition was, you had a meeting, not even a reading, with, I'm forgetting his name, but he's a very famous casting director. He cast Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He cast Dazed and Confused. And the way he would cast these movies, these big ensemble movies with young people, I say young people, but most of the people at the time were older than me. He would just sit down and talk to you, have a conversation with you. And based on that, he would decide if you're coming back to read for the director and producers. You go back and you read for the directors and producers, and then some Saturday, he gets all of the top choices together. So you have like 40 young actors come together at this casting office, and they mix and match, and it's called the pizza party. Don Phillips was his name. Don Phillips pizza party. And he would do the scenes with every version of combination of actors that he could find. And this was like one of the greatest experiences of my life. He comes out and we're all sitting like outside in a courtyard on the ground because we're children. And he says, all roles are open. Everyone will be reading for every role except Ethan Suplee got the part of Willem. That role's off the table. And this was the first thing in the morning. And I was like, what the fuck? I had no idea. And he was like, yes, you are cast, but stick around because we'll have you read scenes with other people. So that was my first movie. It was fucking crazy. My first day auditioning, I got a job. My first movie I ever auditioned for, I got it. And it went on to, you know, and then, you know, at that point I thought like, well, I'm done doing TV. Now I'm just doing movies and I'm going to be a big movie star and I'm on the fucking poster for the movie and this is going to be great. And then it was like a box office disaster. Made $0 in the box office, but then caught on in video with college kids and went on to have like a cult following.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting hearing you talk about like, becoming an actor as a form of escapism, right? Like, because it allowed you to feel like you couldn't be somebody else, or people might see you as somebody else or see you as like, or accept you for who you were and what you were like, but that's escapism. That's like, it's interesting because that's the same thing it's the same word, you know, you're using to describe like your feeling of watching movies. And then like in your feeling of being on set, then was the chance to like put on this armor, or I don't know what you would call it necessarily.
But no. Yeah. Like armor,
to be a shield, right. To be somebody else. Like, when you were in a movie now, like what is your experience on set? Like playing a character, like what it, and there's no, it doesn't have to be that at all. Like I'm more just curious because the thing I'm thinking about is like in the movie we made, Scoot McNairy told me that like, that when he goes to make a movie, that's his time, right? Like he has kids, and you know, other obligations, but like, and he's a dad and he's busy and you know, there's life, you know, I mean, we have kids, you have kids, I have kids, like a parent knows what those other obligations, just life generally, I guess. But Scoot says like, man, like I have to make sure that when I go do a movie, it's with people and doing something that is like for me, right? Like it needs to be fun. It needs to be, because it's like, I don't get to do many things for myself otherwise. And I found that really fascinating. It actually like really resonated with me, or it gave me a lot to think about in the choices I make, is that like, you know, I have limited time to do things with. I have limited time to make things with. I want to make a million things, like don't get me wrong, but I can only get permission to make a few of those things every now and then. But like, it really just resonated with me, like that calculus that went in relative to his experience, right? His set experience and his experience being out somewhere was so important. And it was just not at all how I'd thought someone might think about it. So I'm curious, like now when you go do a movie, what, like, do you get that same, that same feeling that you got back then? Like, well, it's a chance to disappear, or not disappear, but like morph, like
the calculus back then in the beginning was very much like, nothing has given me as much pleasure as, and a lot of it is due to my own mental illness and baggage of like self-loathing, but nothing has separated me from that more than the act of acting. And then the idea that somebody could be looking at me, not because I'm grotesquely fat, but because they have recognized me somewhere, allowed me, even if that's not true, allowed me the moment of potential disbelief for like, I'm not being stared at because I'm grotesque. Maybe they're seeing me because they saw me on TV. So that was true. But I don't know that I could have kept doing it if actually doing it was painful. Doing it is such a joy that it's like, oh my God, I need to do this thing because it nothing makes me feel better. It is the, it is the moment where all of my baggage is lifted off. And now it's funny, Scoot's analogy, because mine is very similar where today, like I'm currently writing a book. I have a book deal. I'm writing a book. That has to play a role in my real life, like making time to do that. Very, very difficult. I too am a husband. I am a parent. I am a grandparent. Like I have life. The only time I get a real break, I don't even get this break on vacation with my wife, which I love to do. That's our time. The only time that is uniquely my own.
That's Ethan's time.
Is when I go to work. When I go to work, I don't have to look at my phone. Nobody can, like, it doesn't matter. You need to get a hold of me. It might be 12 hours and that's okay. Today, if I'm getting a text while we're talking, the minute we're done, I feel anxious that I need to respond. That does not happen when I go away to work. It is uniquely my time. There's not a single thing that could come up, barring like a death in the family, that is going to pull me out of that. There's no, you know, the house floods, figure it out, guys. I am at work and work is sacred.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I love hearing that. Like, but again, there's like, I mean, it's again, it's interesting. There's a little bit of escape. It's like, hey, and being present in that and what you're doing. And I love hearing that. And I love learning that from Scoot too. And I think about that too. Like, I mean, there's nothing I want to do more every single day than make movies and to be making things. And it's hard, you know, it's hard. It can be stressful. It's exhausting, but it's also incredibly, there's nothing else I want to do. Right. And that to me is a good sign, right? Like I would be so pleased to get to make movies every single day or TV. I've never made scripted TV. It's all I think about because of these things that you're talking about. I'm engaged. I'm present. We're making discoveries. I feel like we're finding things. I feel like an explorer, right? And this is so stupid. This analogy is so stupid. Like, but it's truly what I think about. Like, there's very few places left on the earth that I can discover or go to for the first time, besides maybe the bottom of the ocean or to the moon. And I'm probably not going to get to either of those places. Most of the things have been discovered and seen, but when we're making something and we're making something on set, the thing we collectively create it doesn't exist anywhere else. It's like, it's not like finding gold or finding something in a thrift shop. Like, we've found something together and we've also done it as a tribe and as this weird band of misfits. And that process of discovering that and then having it, and then we can show it and share it with somebody else, and it's going to make them feel something. That to me is exhilarating. Like, I want that all the time. I want that all the time. I want that when I walk out of Dune 2 last night. Like, I want that today. I want that independent of like talking to you. Like, I think about that all the time, and like how exciting that is. And even right now, it's like all I can think about is like wanting to go make a movie.
It's amazing, and every scene becomes a riddle. You know, no matter how much you prepare for it or storyboard it or envision it and hire all the people to take what's in your mind and put it out there, you arrive in a place at a time, and it's a riddle. It's still a riddle, and there's problem solving, and you have to, you know, and the good guys can flow with that, and the bad guys are rigid, and it's just like, it is an amazing thing to make a movie.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, I agree. And again, it's like, yeah, it's my favorite thing in the world.
Let's talk about someone who grew up without a TV.
Like,
did you really?
I grew up without a television. Like my folks, we lived in the middle of nowhere on a gravel road, and there wasn't television at all. Or there wasn't like in the woods and in the mountains of upstate New York, there was no cable. You maybe could have had one of those giant satellite dishes, you know, that I don't know if people still remember those. Like they were like, they felt like they were 6 feet across. It looked like a telescope, right? You could find aliens with it if you wanted to. But you couldn't have one where we grew up because there was such a giant tree canopy that you would have to cut like basically like a whole acre of land to be able to get the satellite that was on the ground to aim towards the right point in the sky. So we had no television, and I don't know, maybe my father and mother didn't like television. I don't know what it was, but we had a video rental store in town that was actually a jewelry store that also was an appliance repair shop. And the man who ran the jewelry store and the appliance repair shop that had a VHS hallway on the side was also my school bus driver. And his name was Pete Parker. And it was and to this day, it's like, it feels like this strange, like Venn diagram of like things, like, you know, the fact that his name was Pete Parker and that I grew up without a TV, there was something in the air that about it that was magical. And so I would find ways to invite myself over to friends' houses so that we could watch movies because they had VHS players and televisions or big brothers that could rent the R-rated movies that we were not allowed to watch. And I did not have Truffaut or Godard or this video rental store. It had just a handful of movies, and it was like Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, Steven Seagal movies, but then also like, you know, Blade Runner and Terminator 2 and sort of these like genre classics. I mean, The Abyss and Full Metal Jacket and RoboCop. And so that I loved movies. And I loved those movies, and I just craved them all the time because there was something so magical and all these things we're talking about. So anyway, I grew up without a TV. I had to like seek out movies at every turn, and I did. And so it's funny because like my mother often like laughs out loud. She's like, it's really funny that you ended up like loving movies so much and wanting to make movies so much. You didn't even have movies in your life. And I was like, well, maybe that's why I love it. So right. I don't know. It wasn't like purposeful. It just like happened to be the way things played out. So
magical. And if they hit you in that way, it's just like, you know, I don't want to downplay the loss of life, and a lot of businesses went out of business, and the world changed during the pandemic. For me, one of the biggest hardships, you know, I couldn't go to the gym for a while. That was very hard on my life. But then the idea, like my favorite movie theater in Los Angeles was this movie theater, and it was just a small Los Angeles chain called the Arclight, and that went out of business. And
I know
that was the only movie theater I would go to. And they had a few. There was one in the Valley. There was one in Pasadena. There was one in Hollywood.
I would go
to all of them, but like for a number of years, I took my kids to every Star Wars opening the day it opened at the Cinerama Dome, and people would be dressed up, and it was like an experience. The only other real experience you can have is like Man's Chinese. That's a fucking amazing theater, but it's smack dab in Hollywood Boulevard, which is a bit of a shit show. So I would never opt to go to that theater. You know, I've been to that theater obviously, but the fact that there was a period where it almost seemed like movie theaters were done, you know, I went to see Top Gun in the theater, and I watched it and felt a relief because it really meant to me, we're not done. Movie theaters aren't done. We're still going to be able to have this experience. which is like a sacred thing for me. And I'm also lazy and will watch shit streaming at my house. And I love all there's lots of great TV shows that are being made in limited runs, you know, fantastic. But like, if it can't just be Marvel movies, we need movies to survive. Yeah. You know, I'm glad I saw Poor Things in the theater. I'm glad I saw Bones and All in the theater. I really liked that movie. Nobody else liked it, but I liked it.
And who cares what anybody else likes?
You're right. Exactly. And fucking
it truly doesn't matter.
I saw Dune 2 in a regular theater and left going, I must see this in IMAX. That's all I knew. I have to, like, I loved this so much. I have to see this in 70 millimeter. And I'm so glad I did. I would go fucking see it again. You know, like, I'm so glad movies are surviving. And I'm so thankful that I've gotten to play a part in making movies. In the history of movies, I'm in there. You're in there. We're part of movies. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah, dude. You're definitely in there. Like, I'm trying to be in there. You know, we're trying to be more and more in there. But it's hearing you talk about the arc light. We lived in LA from 2011 to 14, and I used to make my girlfriend, then fiance, then wife, go when we would go to the movies. We would need to get there very early because I needed the best seats. And the Arclight was the first cinema that I went to, I think, that had reserved seating. And it changed my life because I did not need to get my wife to the theater an hour ahead of time, which she hated. And I was like, no, but I'm paying good money and I'm going to have the best seat in this house. Yeah. And now I think like reserved seating is much more commonplace. But like, I mean, I became an Arclight member immediately, merely because I was like, well, obviously the quality and the experience was like incredible. And there was such love in those rooms, especially, and we lived right in Hollywood, or we lived in, Los Feliz. So we went to the one in Hollywood for the most part, but like, I was like, fucking reserved seating. Like, that's a game changer. Like, and to this day, it's like, I did show up. I walked into Dune 2 1 minute before like the screening time last night, because I knew my seat was dead center and like, it was going to be there. And sure as shit there were people everywhere else. Except
but
my
your
one
seat was
and I
ready.
Was like, I was like, this is how I want it. Like, I couldn't get there sooner. I had to put the kids to bed and we were like, of course, you know, cleaning up chaos in the house. So anyway, I thank the Arclight for that. Like, I don't know if the Arclight had a hand in like making other cinemas like top reserve seating, but God bless them if they did.
You know? Yeah. I was so into being an Arclight member and felt a pride in my points. I had, you get
same.
Points.
Oh, cause you could redeem the points for
you could redeem
screenings.
The points. But
our food.
Food. So one time, we sit down to watch a movie, and my wife says something like, "I want to go get snacks. Can I have some money?" I hand her a wad of cash, and she goes and comes back with like an obscene amount of stuff. Like, and I was like, "What the fuck? This is a lot of snacks." And she's like, "Yeah, and here's your money," and handed me all the money back. And I was like, "Wait. What are you talking about?"
She burned all your points?
She said, I just told him your phone number and everything was free. And I was like, you go fucking pay for this. I want my points back. Like, I was so like incensed because I had like a game with my friends, like how many Arclight points, and we would compare points, and I was always in the lead. And I was like, you're not going to enough movies. And then my wife spent it on popcorn. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Are you a Sky Miles collector? Like,
oh yeah.
I have to like,
yeah.
Okay. Right. Like,
but I spend those.
I do too, but like Arclight points are like, you know, I guess like membership points or what, like exclusivity points, like make me feel rich, even though they really are. I mean, like the number of points you had to spend at the Arclight to get like a bag of popcorn was like insane. I love the points. I still love the points. I love Sky Miles. Like they make me feel like I have some secret currency that I can do lots more than I can do with than I clearly can. But I like having them. I like hoarding. I do like using them too, but I do like hoarding them. My wife would laugh again. She's like, you hoard points and like all, and she's like, you don't ever let them go. I'm like, no, but it's, I'm rich on paper.
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. But and then you spend them and you're like, oh my God, 50,000 points to fly coach to New York. Yeah. It's exactly. A lot of points. Exactly. And exactly. Then, yeah, it makes me not want to spend them. And then every time I'm like, no, just spend them because it's cheaper than whatever the plane ticket costs. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. It's true.
That's amazing. Anyway. Rod, this has been such a joyful conversation and we fucking hit everything. We hit movies. We hit health. We hit weight. We hit all of it. Thank you so much.
Man, thanks for having me. It means a lot. Like, I'm always down to talk. I love you and I love like your, I don't know, your honesty and your enthusiasm and your, like, the joy that you have for people and artistry and work. And I don't know, there's just this positivity to it that, like, I really love, and I love being around. I know we've made one movie together. We're going to make another movie together soon and many together. So I'm always excited to talk to you. Doesn't have to be on camera.
Doesn't have to be
on the podcast there.
Let's have a standing date. We should always do this for every movie we do, at least.
Sold. Greenlit.
Awesome. All right, dude. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Ethan.
And now for the Q&A.
Today's question comes from Nico.
Hi, Nico.
Nico says, I've been a yo-yo lifer of weight gain and loss. Recently, I saw a video picture of myself that motivated me to get back in the gym consistently. I'm down 25 pounds with exercise and diet, but I recently rolled my ankle. How do you recommend that I stay focused on the journey when I experience these setbacks or bumps in the road?
Well, I mean, you know, like, if we're talking about weight loss, the majority of progress you'll make with weight loss is diet. So a rolled ankle should not affect weight loss. And there's still a ton of upper body stuff you can do in a gym that doesn't involve your ankle. You could even continue to work out your good leg that doesn't have an injured ankle. And there's a ton of evidence that suggests that your injured leg will get benefit from working out the other leg. So, like, I ruptured my right bicep tendon, and that's why I looked into the data on asymmetrical exercise and the effects on injured limbs. And I found, like, a lot of evidence that suggests, like, oh, if I just do curls on my left arm, my right arm, like, my nervous system somehow is sending impulses to my right arm, and it's actually helpful. So there's, like, a ton of stuff you can continue doing physically with a rolled ankle. And then if we're just talking about weight loss alone, that is so predominantly diet-based that, like, a rolled ankle should have no effect on it. Now, like, if you're sitting more and, like, watching more TV and recuperating and bored, yeah, I understand that there will be a stronger desire to eat. Those are many of the times I experience a stronger desire to eat. You want a snack, you want, you know, do stuff like that. And so you're just going to have to be aware that that's occurring and, like, fight it.
Yeah.
That's my whole batch of advice for you, Nico. A rolled ankle should now, like, I get, like, if you're training to run a marathon and you roll your ankle, like, that's going to be a big setback. That's not the way this question was posed. This is about yo-yo dieting, and your diet should have nothing to do with your ankle.
Yeah. I hear that for me. I hear that. Awesome. Well, thank you, Nico, for your question. Anyone else out there with a question? You know you have one. Send it to us at hello@americanglutton.net.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee. You can follow us on Instagram @American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.